Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
Even the best civil servants with the broadest experience do not stay in government forever. Sometimes a new administration is not pursuing the interests they have always been passionate about, and sometimes it is just time for a new challenge, which the private sector might offer. Whatever the reason for his move, our guest today is one of those well-seasoned government officials. He was the chief of the Federal Communications Enforcement Bureau in the Obama years, worked as a senior advisor to former California Attorney General and now vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris, and as a special assistant attorney general of California. But today he is the vice chair of Cooley's Cyber Data and Privacy Practice, a role he combines with the membership of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. We have asked Travis LeBlanc to give us his perspectives on a variety of issues, from Schrems II and the CPRA to the possibility of US federal legislation on the horizon. But as always, we just let the conversation flow, so who knows what else may come up. My name is Paul Breitbart.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. I am absolutely delighted that Travis has joined us today, and I told him I was going to save this story about why I love him so much, because you were on stage at the IAPP summit, I don't know, 4 years ago, 2016, I believe it was. And I was in the audience. I was brand new to Twitter at the time, and they were encouraging us to tweet out anything that we liked about it. And I remember the person from the FTC was giving a summary of what the FTC does. I don't remember who it was, didn't make an impression, was very boring. And then you, in your fabulous socks that you were wearing, was like, hey, all I have to say is it's not Superman versus Batman. We're all here to save the world. You killed me. Absolutely killed me. I was laying in the aisle, dying. They were calling for resuscitation and emergency personnel. Disrupted the entire thing. I'm kidding. But no, thank you. So you've been a hero of mine for a long time, and I know you're on the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board as well, so you're still remaining a hero. But now for the most important part, Travis, the unexpected question.
Uh-oh.
What is your favorite day of the week?
My favorite day of the week is Saturday. You know, I like it because it signifies clearly the end of the week. And the next week is not beginning on Sunday. And Sunday can be stressful because the day, you know, Monday is when the week begins. So Saturday is the day that I find to be most relaxing and most enjoyable.
Nice. I love it, Paul. I like that you had to think about that too.
It was a good question.
Well, Kay, how could it be any other day than Thursday when we record our podcast?
Actually, Thursday is my favorite day of the week. And for almost the exact same reasons that Travis gave, but you know, Paul, I'm going to add your reason to it because absolutely it's our recording day. So I look forward to it. But no, to me, Travis, what you were saying, Saturday is absolutely the weekend. Thursday to me is the last day before the weekend because Friday is the weekend. Everybody's already celebrating Friday. It's the weekend. So my favorite day is Thursday. And I think both my daughters were born on Thursday.
Yeah, it has been Thursday for me for a long time.
Has it? Why?
Well, when I was still a civil servant, I started at the Senate, as you may recall. Thursday night is the civil servants' nights out here in The Hague, probably the same in Washington, D.C., also because on Friday, lots of people are working from home, or when we still had to go to the office, then there was only one day a week where people would work from home. And on Fridays, there would be no committee meetings, there would be no parliamentary sessions. So it would be much more easy to work from home. And also for all the people in the ministries, Friday is the day that the Council of Ministers meets, which means that there was less to do in the ministry, so it's easier to work from home. So Thursday night was the night where everybody would come together in the bars around our parliament. And that was just always fabulous.
I love it. And Travis, just assure me that you still celebrate Saturdays.
Oh, I definitely still celebrate.
I know we're on day 3,791 of April, but you still celebrate Saturdays, right?
Yeah, I mean, it runs together.
Wait, is it April yet? It's still March, right?
I mean, it does run together, right? And this Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday has a tendency to blend. And I do think mental health reasons for everyone and wellness, that it's good to have a little separation and, you know, from work during the week. And I think that's hard to do Monday to Friday. It's just, even on Thursday, it's hard, you know, whether it's because there are clients or there's government business taking place or there's news that's taking place that you get caught up in, you know, some new decision comes out on a Thursday. I don't remember if it was Thursday, but I think
it was a Thursday.
Yes, it was a Thursday, Paul. I just had to remind you.
Thursday will still be my favorite, right?
You know, whereas on Saturday, things just slow down from all those other distractions. And, you know, other than family, it is, you know, it's something that allows you a little bit more control over your own day. And I think that's just hard to do during the week.
Or it should give you some control over your own day. If people out there are not celebrating their Saturdays, we got some really good advice for you, right?
That's right.
Make sure you do it. And it is. This is exhausting for us. Everybody's sitting down taking meetings for 10 hours a day. You can't tell one day from the other. I know in the beginning people were doing certain themes for days to try to separate them. You feel like a kid, you needed to get some underwear for every day of the week so you knew what day it was. But I think now people, maybe we need to have like a theme for one day a week. Every Tuesday you do something or every Thursday you do something. That way you can tell day from each other. But you mentioned news. And so I know Paul probably has a fantastic question about maybe some news that we've experienced lately. Which one would you like to start with, Paul?
Oh, there are so many to start with, but maybe just let's start with the obvious, and that is Schrems 2, because it will still be on everybody's minds.
My obvious
and we promised our... I know. We'll hold that one as a cliffhanger. let's go to Schrems 2 first, because Travis, I do believe that we have had conversations in the past when I was still with the Working Party 29 and you were still with the FCC in the run-up to the Privacy Shield, one of those big panels with people from all around the world trying to figure out what to do with Schrems 1. And recently we found each other in a similar call on what to do with Schrems 2. What do you make of it from your perspective and given your background and experience?
Well, a lot has been said about both Schrems 1 and Schrems 2. So I don't want to say that, you know, I'm going to have something that is purely genius here. But you're right to note, Paul, that I was involved at post Schrems 1 in government, you know, in my capacity in government. Now I'll probably be involved again in post Schrems 2. My view is that the fundamental concerns that Europe has expressed about the national security intelligence collection programs and activities of the US government are the same today as they were four years ago. They have
only
not.
4 years ago.
Yeah, I think it's four. I'm doing it in my head, but I think it's four, as they were 4 years ago, that fundamentally the post-Snowden concerns that motivated a lot of Schrems 1 have not been resolved in the minds of the Europeans. And I'm not sure that in any time soon, in the absence of some change of law, that they are ultimately going to be resolved. You know, I am concerned that obviously the concerns that the ECJ expressed in TRIMS 2 about the national security activities are true, whether you were a member of Privacy Shield or whether you relied upon SCCs and BCRs. I think what the ECJ learned is that it has a role in policymaking, and it did realize that if they struck everything down, they would send us into chaos. And so they gave us these other avenues that they left open for transatlantic data flows, even though concerns that they raised about Privacy Shield would generally be applicable to those as well. I'm also concerned that unlike the conversations that took place between the United States and Europe post-TRIMS 1, right now, it's not clear to me that there is a person or agency within the intelligence community in the United States that is taking ownership and leadership for ensuring that there is a new, quote unquote, enhanced Privacy Shield, whatever is the successor. Post TRIMS 1, Bob Litt, who was then the general counsel at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, ODNI, was willing to reach out to Europe, built credibility with the regulators, sent a letter that was quite influential in ultimately persuading the Europeans to agree to Privacy Shield. As you all know, the Department of Commerce, which led those negotiations then too, but it has no jurisdiction over national security. The Federal Trade Commission has no jurisdiction over the national security programs of the United States. Within ODNI right now, the general counsel, you know, there isn't a permanent general counsel. There's currently a nominee whose confirmation is pending in the Senate right now, but there isn't someone there. The FBI just got a new general counsel, maybe in the last week, that was appointed by the FBI director, Chris Wray. The Privacy and Civil Liberties Unit that is within the Department of Justice at the time of TRIMS 1 was located in the Office of the Deputy Attorney General, the number two at the Department of Justice. I don't believe that's the case anymore. And so the concern that I have is if we're going to have a conversation or a negotiation with the Europeans, we have to get someone in the administration, in the national security component, that is going to take ownership for that and negotiate that. And normally in bilateral negotiations between the United States and another country, you would have the Department of State taking lead on those negotiations. But that's not even the case here. It's the Department of Commerce. You know, so I think at the end of the day, it is highly unlikely that we are going to see any resolution around Privacy Shield before the election. I think it's highly unlikely that we're probably going to see it before 2021 as well. So I think if you're a company that relies upon or sought to rely in the past upon Privacy Shield, one might as well begin the process of looking for an alternative vehicle for transatlantic data flows, because we're going to have to be in this the long time. And if there isn't going to be a change in law, then there will likely be a TRIMS 3 in a few more years for whatever is the replacement, unless we can get some real comfort to the ECJ, not just the European Commission, but to the ECJ over the adequacy of the protections for privacy and civil liberties. And the final thing I will say about it that really perplexes me is that instead of giving guidance to the industry that in this time where the ECJ has invalidated Privacy Shield, to find an alternative vehicle that the Europeans would recognize as sufficiently, you know, adequate, we have the Department of Commerce and the Federal Trade Commission that are both telling people Privacy Shield is still alive and they're still practicing and they're still processing applications like nothing happened on July 16th. That was totally irrelevant to the way the world continues to operate. And it seems to me that that is causing a lot of confusion to companies that continue to possibly submit applications, continue to potentially transfer data in reliance on Privacy Shield, when the Europeans are saying again and again, there's no grace period. It has been invalidated, and it would behoove us to give some clarity as a U.S. government to companies, not to encourage them to rely upon a framework that Europe has definitively said repeatedly is invalidated.
Yes, that's certainly true. It's not the first time that the court has made similar suggestions. And it's also for the European Commission, I think, a hard lesson to learn that they should take the court seriously, because the court has said time and again that they don't like interferences into fundamental rights when they are not proportional, when they are not warranted, when they are not sufficiently clear and limited to what is absolutely necessary. The commission has seen that also in cases related to passenger name records and the telecommunications data, all just, well, national European laws, so only applicable within the European Union. And there they still haven't learned the lesson either. So I think also in the European Commission, if they want to put a new proposal on the table, it will require quite a lot of work for them to change the approach that they have used so far in order to create something that will stand the test of the courts.
Yeah, I think that is a fair challenge that the commission now faces. It needs to craft an agreement that is realistic, that will survive the scrutiny of the ECJ at a time when the United States has only so much that it can do without a change to our laws. And I think that balance, the European Commission has worked out. I mean, every year there was an annual review. I participated in the annual review last year. It was quite extensive. It's not a pure formality that takes place. The members from Europe, from the DPAs that showed up, and from the commission that negotiated and conducted that review, were very well apprised of developments in United States law. You know, from the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board perspective, they had read our reports. They knew the projects that we were working on. They were well attuned to the legal authorities that we had, and they asked, you know, very educated questions to give themselves some assurances about the commitments that had been made previously and what they should expect the next year. Unfortunately, I don't think the ECJ had the benefit of all the information that they have available to them at the commission about what the United States does and does not do. And moreover, I have real concerns about how the ECJ could harmonize its legal analysis of the United States surveillance practices with the practices of the United Kingdom, of the Five Eye countries, and ultimately with a number of the member countries in Europe. And I think that is a challenge that they are creating for themselves in the future that they will have to deal with and reckon with, is how to distinguish between what those countries do and what the United States does for purposes of adequacy, or risk entering a world where they essentially have 11 countries or 10 countries that are adequate and nothing else.
Well, unfortunately, that is very hard for the court to do, because they are not allowed to do so, because the national security of the member states, and that means all the intelligence services here in Europe, are outside of scope of the EU treaties. So the court is not allowed to say anything about it. And I think it is not something that is sustainable. This provision from the treaties should go and probably already has been voided by the member states themselves by adopting national security legislation through counterterrorism measures for years and years. but it is still in the treaties, and that means that the court can't do anything about it. Luckily, we also have the court in Strasbourg, which is allowed to also judge on intelligence and security services activities and has done so in the past. And there is not much light between what the court says about US law and what the court in Strasbourg says about the European member states and what they can and cannot do. The conclusion is that any interference with the fundamental rights of individuals needs to be foreseeable, needs to be restricted to what is absolutely necessary, and that redress should be possible.
Paul, while in my view, the United States still has room to improve its transparency around surveillance activities, as well as the protection for privacy and civil liberties, the United States, as a result of the Snowden releases, has become much more transparent than probably any other government about its surveillance practices. And what is concerning is that other countries are way less transparent about those practices and activities. And as a result of that transparency, the U.S. government is being held to a standard that some of its peer countries don't quite have to live up to. And I think the European Commission does understand that. I take your point about the fact that the ECJ will never get the chance to opine on it, although they can deal with the United Kingdom and the Five Eyes and others. That will be there. It is that discord or disconnection between what the U.S. does and what others do, and how the U.S. is the country that receives the most scrutiny for lots of various reasons, that concerns me in terms of, you know, not just transatlantic data flows, but ultimately the concept of an open internet and open data flows around the world. And what I fear is that decisions like the ECJ and activities like some other countries risk balkanizing data at the end of the day and balkanizing the internet. And I think that's a real concern that we should all be looking at as to where we ultimately end up if Europe and the United States, which are allies, very, very strong allies, which largely, you know, engage in similar practices, can't find a resolution that is adequate. I do recognize fully that when it comes to the concept of privacy as a fundamental human right, U.S. law has not reached where Europe is. I fully recognize that when it comes to the ability to challenge the surveillance practices of the United States government, U.S. persons and European data subjects don't necessarily have the same rights to challenge those activities in a court in the United States or as they might in Europe. There's room for improvement in the U.S. I'm just not sure that holding transatlantic data flows hostage is the way to ultimately achieve that result.
No, I think you are right there. Kay, are you still with us?
Oh, are you talking about because y'all got really deep into significant government, you know, cross-Atlantic interactions between Working Party 29 and the FCC? Yeah, I'm still here. I dozed off for a second there, but I'm still here.
I'm sorry, Paul and I were having a moment.
No, actually, I was sitting there thinking while you were talking about this, that if our relations really are so good, and I think they are, and of course the conversation between y'all makes me believe that they have been in the past and they will continue to be so in the future, how long do you think we're going to see a renegotiated setup here? And how successful can that possibly be, given that we're not going to get rid of all the laws that Europe doesn't like that we have for government surveillance?
I think Travis might be right that it will depend on the elections and the outcome of the elections.
Yes, it's not like I was deliberately trying to lead the conversation towards that possible topic. I mean, I would never manipulate it that way, right?
No, but it will be dependent on that, because in any case, before the elections, I doubt that a lot will happen. Yeah. And whatever solution will need to be found, whether it is under a second Trump government or under a Biden administration, it will probably require at least some involvement of Congress as well, because it's clear that the exchange of letters is not sufficient for the court. And that means that to get legislation done, it will take time, and it will probably only be happening next year. So let's hope that we can do it within a year.
Without getting too deep into the politics here in the United States, I do think that it is not a wild guess to say that Kamala Harris, VP nominee, has an interest in privacy. Always has. She's been a driver of that for a while. So should that election happen where she is part of the winning party, do you think we have a greater chance at a federal law quicker?
That's a good question. I mean, look, the debate over federal baseline privacy legislation, heck, even a federal law on data breach notifications, you know, has been longstanding. What, in my view, holds the federal law from being passed by Congress are concerns over preemption and a private right of action. I think fundamentally, those are the two biggest drivers. I don't think it really is about the lack of sophistication of the U.S. Congress in terms of being able to craft substantive privacy protections in a federal law. There is a big debate about, one, should states still be able to have their own separate substantive privacy regimes? California, as you know, passed the Consumer Privacy Act, and it's enacted. The California that the citizens of California, the residents of California, have an inalienable right to privacy. It's an Article 1 of the Constitution.
One of 11 states that addresses privacy in the Constitution.
That's exactly right.
Arizona's one of them too, but we don't quite use that language.
That's exactly right. You know, the Speaker of the House is from California. If the Democrat are to win the presidential election, the vice president would be from California. The idea that, and I think it's something like, don't quote me on this, 20% of the Congress is from California.
Okay, got it.
The idea that all of those people are going to suddenly come together and negate the most substantive privacy law in the country, one that also is now, you know, going potentially revised on the ballot in November. And if it passes in November, the people will have spoken, just strikes me as unlikely. So I think we have to find some kind of resolution to preemption. But realistically speaking, I think the dynamics are there. We also have not seen a number of other states that have passed the equivalent of the CCPA at the state level. So the concern that there would be 45 different laws that would, you know, all have different substantive protection hasn't proven to be the case, at least as of this point. On the private right.
Yeah, my guess was that it was going to be single digit number of states. So I was thinking 7 to 9 states would pass them this year. But alas, they had bigger things to worry about and didn't happen.
Right. So that fear, while it's still there, it has not come to fruition. And I think the second big issue is if you were, you know, and I think also when it comes to preemption, it's really hard to have that conversation because you have to ask yourself, well, preempt what? What are we actually putting in place?
Right.
You can't have a conversation about preempting CCPA if we don't have an understanding about what the alternative is to that right now. The second issue is about enforcement of whatever new federal law would be there. Does enforcement rest solely with the Federal Trade Commission? Well, the Federal Trade Commission's jurisdiction is limited. It doesn't have jurisdiction over every single company in the United States.
Right.
Its resources are extremely limited, particularly over the last number of years where the budget of the FTC has been dramatically reduced. I believe the FTC has about 40 to 50 people that work on privacy full time. Compare that to the ICO, yeah, where they're, you know, they probably had 1,000, you know, these days, you know, in Canada. And I could go country to country in Europe, and you'd see that the numbers are dramatically higher. So could we really rely upon?
Well, and they raised the number of personnel with GDPR. I think they had very small offices until GDPR, frankly. But on the other hand, Paul, remind me, who was it that we were talking to recently that were saying that they really liked the idea of maintaining governance over federal privacy?
I think it was Pedro.
Do what?
I think it was Pedro. Pedro Pavon.
Oh, might have been. So we were talking about how the CPRA would create an institution, might actually be a good thing on the federal level. And of course, the pushback we got was, well, no, the FTC is actually doing a good job. But you make a great point here, and I don't think we discussed it then. FTC doesn't have jurisdiction over all industries or all businesses.
There are a number of carve-outs to the FTC's jurisdiction. It has no jurisdiction over nonprofits. It has no jurisdiction over common, you know, there's, you know, over airlines. It has no jurisdiction over certain banks, a lot of banks. It has no jurisdiction over common carriers, in telecommunications carriers, insofar as they are, you know, engaging in common carriage. So there are, and it has no jurisdiction over the government. So there are a lot of
there's some significant gaps over what it can't jurisdict over.
That's exactly right. So it's got limited jurisdiction. Even though they've done a lot with their Section 5 authority, and the FTC has built up, as Dan Soloff says, a common law around privacy that is quite substantial, and it would be a shame to lose that. I think we should have a serious conversation about whether the FTC's jurisdiction needs to be reviewed if it's going to be the sole enforcer at the federal level, the additional resources that it needs, or whether, like the CPRA, there should be a separate privacy agency that works on privacy full time. Right now, the only agency.
What do you lean towards?
I lean towards a separate agency of the federal government that works on privacy and security issues full time, like our peer countries have done, like California is considering right now on the ballot initiative, that it's high time that we have a separate agency that can function, whether it's a commission or some other structure that is working on privacy and security full time. It is too substantial of an issue that permeates across the entire activities of the government, across industry, across the lives of people, to not be able to have an agency that is full-time dedicated to focusing on privacy in the United States, just like our peers have done.
Agreed.
Interesting.
I say let's appoint Travis to run it.
Sure, why not?
We have a lot to do right now.
It could happen. I have hope for the future. I can have. What? Where are you going with that, Paul?
Nowhere immediately. I was just wondering what Travis makes of the CPRA. I mean, you're positive, obviously, about the enforcement agency, but it seems that there is a lot of resistance, especially from civil society groups, against CPRA. And I still don't understand. I mean, I do understand that they think it doesn't go far enough, that it should be even better. But to me, when I read it, it seems to be an improvement from the CCPA. So why be against something that still is an improvement, even though it is not good enough? Can you make any sense out of that yet, Travis?
Well, look, I think you don't get opportunities very regularly, or at least what I'm about to say is generally true. CPA, CPRA is the exception. You don't get opportunities to substantively address privacy issues often. The legislature or the people are going to tackle it one time, and then they probably won't see it again for another decade or, you know, 15 years. In California, for example, just since we're in California, you know, it's, I haven't done the math on it, but it's probably been 25 years since affirmative action was outlawed by a ballot initiative. California is about to revisit that. It is revisiting it in substantial form this year, you know, 25 years later. I think there's a concern that, number one, a ballot initiative is kind of like super law. Once it is passed, it can only be changed by another ballot initiative. The legislature can't overrule it. So if it doesn't go far enough or it contradicts something that you might want to see enacted, the only way you could challenge that would be by another ballot initiative in the future. So when you don't go far enough, or you create limitations that are, you know, particularly challenging. I think also,
I wasn't aware
given
of that.
The seismic change in California's privacy law with the CCPA, with the CPRA, if it passes, how much more air will there be in the room for the kinds of additional protections that the civil society would like to see? And then I think thirdly, and I think this is a problem we all have to address, is fundamentally privacy does, you know, and the privacy community has not treated social justice issues as adequately.
You know Pedro, right?
I do know Pedro. That's exactly right. As adequately as many in the sort of civil rights community would like to see. You know, oftentimes when we have a conversation around privacy and we're thinking about who's going to be the advocacy community, we reach out to the civil liberties organizations.
Right.
But civil liberties concerns and civil rights concerns are not necessarily the same. We have we have a lot of surveillance or privacy practices that disproportionately impact certain communities, maybe people of color, for example, or women, or LGBTQ. And when we evaluate those practices, we're thinking about privacy writ large across the entire population, even though lower income people or people of color may suffer intrusions into their privacy at a disproportionate rate as compared to others. It is high time that we begin to think about the impact that practices, that privacy practices and surveillance activities have on discrete communities that we're concerned about. It shouldn't be the case that only the wealthy get access to privacy features. It shouldn't be the case that people of color have their privacy rights intruded upon more than others. And so when we do privacy impact assessments, we should be thinking not just about writ large how this affects privacy, but also how this is impacting equality at the end of the day. And building in concerns about equality to ensure that we are not inscribing through our practices discriminatory policies that no one would have actually intended to do if they had thought about it. And so I think there's a real concern by a number of the civil rights communities about how certain protections do or don't actually protect their communities of interest that they're thinking about on a day-to-day basis.
Right. And when we were talking about that with Pedro in one of our prior podcasts, I made the comment that if we're going to overcome this, well, we were all talking about it. If we're going to overcome this, we need to make sure that those perspectives are not only welcome in the design processes and the review processes, but that the people that are in those roles understand that we want them to bring those perspectives. And I want to clarify, because this has bothered me for a little while, that I might have given the impression that we're going to rely on those disadvantaged populations to speak up for themselves. That's not true. That's not what we need to do. What we need to do is make sure that they know we welcome, we want, we celebrate, we need their input into these processes. Because all too often they purposefully hold back their own views on what to do because it's just not the accepted practice. They don't speak up because we haven't traditionally listened. And so it's not on the impacted minority populations to speak up for themselves. It's on the world in general, society in general, to speak up on their behalf and to make sure that their voices are heard.
I agree. We cannot push.
We have to be in this together.
That's exactly right. We cannot push all the responsibility on the disadvantaged communities to raise their hand and speak up without recognizing that we have a social justice responsibility, you know, to ensure that we're also thinking about these issues.
Yes.
And, you know, if that means we need to do equality impact assessments in addition to privacy impact assessments, or we need to add a component to a privacy impact assessment that includes equality, we need to take at this time, with everything at least that the United States is going through around its, you know, its conversation over systemic racism, we really need to think about how we can ensure that privacy practices are not also perpetuating that systemic inequality that may be there just because people are unconscious about it. It's something right. that we have to raise to the forefront of our consciousness so that we are all acting responsibly to mitigate those issues before they ever get into the stream of commerce or the use by government or by law enforcement.
Exactly.
I love your passion.
My daughters and I all have disabilities. One of the things that we have often had to advocate for are the justice rights for people with disabilities. And there's this image that is always stuck in my head, and you brought this to mind when you mentioned equality, of three kids trying to look over the fence to watch a baseball game. And of course, they're three different heights. There's little, there's medium, there's big. Equality would give them all a one-foot box. And so all of them would just be raised 1 foot, which means the tall one can see over the fence, but the medium and the small one still can't because they're equal. They were given equal treatment. Justice treatment would give the tall one a 1 foot box, the medium a 2 foot box, and the little one a 3 foot box. That way they all wind up on the same height and they all have the same view. And so there's a little bit of a difference where people talk about, and I know you didn't mean it this way, but when people talk about equality, they mean giving everybody the same chance. Justice means making up for the disadvantages that we may have imposed on them already and making sure that the result is that they have the equal opportunity.
Yeah, so there's the whole big debate in the civil rights community about what equality means. You know, is it
right?
Is equality of opportunity, or, you know, is it literally getting the same thing? Right. So we could have that. You know, I was not making a judgment about which one of those we embrace.
Oh, I know.
Suffice it to say, I tend to lean more into the equality of opportunity camp, to make sure that everyone actually has an equal chance to be able to participate
right.
in society. And
which is the justice perspective.
That's right. Justice, fairness, you know, equality, you know, we could kind of craft out a definition for each one, but that's something that I do recognize is a conversation that one would need to have if you're going to go down the road of talking about equality is what do we mean by equality? Do we just
exactly.
mean that it has no more of an impact on the disadvantaged community as the majority, or, you know, does it mean that we need to ensure that the disadvantaged community has the ability to take advantage of this product or service or right?
I like the way you put
as
that.
Equally as the people in the majority do. So I think that's a conversation worth having about what does equality mean in the context of mitigating or remediating privacy concerns.
Right. And I believe in privacy where we're situated or we're poised. We're on the brink of actually trying to get to that point. In many cases, the field of privacy has offered a lot of equality and a lot of justice. And I think we're quickly recognizing some of the disadvantages that we have and trying to address them as a community. So there's a lot of things I love about the field of privacy, but I do recognize that we are running out of time and I could literally continue this conversation for 3 more hours, except everybody else would jump off the recording and I'd be talking to myself. But Travis, thank you, thank you, thank you so much. We would normally say, is there anything you would like to share that when you came on the show, you wanted to make sure you got across, but I talked you out of time.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me. It's great to be with both of you. I'm an avid listener of the podcast, and I'm thrilled to have had the chance to join you for one of these episodes.
Oh, we have loved having you.
Well, welcome Travis back anytime, and I'm sure there will be much more to discuss going forward. If, like Travis, you like our series, please subscribe and like our podcast in your favorite podcast afterward. Should you have any questions or suggestions, reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or via Twitter at podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as Europol B. Thank you again for listening to Serious Privacy, and until our next episode, where we'll do something special. Goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.